I'm Ryan Miller, Crops Extension Educator. Earlier this morning, we recorded an episode of the Strategic Farming Field Notes program. Strategic Farming Field Notes is a weekly program addressing current crop production topics. A live webinar is hosted at 8 a.m. on Wednesdays throughout the cropping season. During the live webinar, participants can join in the discussion and get questions answered. An audio recording of the live program is released following the webinar via podcast platforms. Thanks, and remember to tune in weekly for a discussion on current cropping and crop management topics.
Again, welcome to Strategic Farming Field Notes. This is a program from the University of Minnesota Extension. These sessions are brought to you by the University of Minnesota Extension with generous support from farm families throughout the state of Minnesota, and also by the Minnesota Soybean Research and Promotion Council and the Minnesota Corn Research and Promotion Council. So we're happy that you're joining us for today's session here on soybean cyst nematode. We'll talk a little bit about soybean diseases and also about manure and nutrient management as well. My name is Dave Nicolai, and I'll be moderating today's episode. We have two guests that will be with us today, Bruce Potter. Bruce is the Extension and Integrated Pest Management Specialist out of our Southwest Research and Outreach Center at Lamberton, and also Melissa Wilson. She is Assistant Professor in Manure Nutrient Management and Water Quality from the University of Minnesota Department of Soil, Water, and Climate. Well, we all know that it's been a wet spring out there, and obviously a lot of ponding and other complications in dealing with soybeans and soybean management. So before we proceed a little bit more, I think we'll turn it over to Bruce and talk a little bit about some of these soybeans out there. And Bruce, you know, I've noticed, you know, obviously there's variability in your corn, but I think we've got variability in soybeans as well. You know, this time of the year, we oftentimes run into crops that don't look very good, maybe a little bit on the yellow side, aren't as thrifty. There might be some field history here as well. What are some things that come to mind, especially at this time of the year, I guess, Bruce, in terms of making sure that we understand, are we dealing with iron chlorosis? Are we dealing with soybean cyst nematode? You know, some of these other hidden things that don't show up, you know, right away until maybe this time of the year.
Thanks for having me, Dave. I think the issue here we've got this year that makes it a little more tough is we've got so much water, and we've got some water stress on these soybeans. And, you know, we've got issues with just soybeans just plain drowning. We've got issues with root disease. We're starting to see some more issues with SCN. And I think the trick right now is, when you're looking at these fields, is kind of try to prioritize exactly what's the main reason you've got an issue out there. We've got some fields here where, you know, even from the road, it looks different, and you get out there and it's because we've got a lot of missing plants, combination of disease and combination of just plain too much water in soybean plants. They can drown, and that's what happened in some cases. We've had a lot of unusual amount of root disease this year because of the wet weather, and right now we're starting to see some soybeans that are yellowing up. It's a late season yellowing. Typically, if you've got an iron chlorosis issue or IDC problem, that happens early in the year. If we see yellowing beans right now, there's two things that I suspect. One of those is SCN. And related to SCN, they don't have to occur together, but often they do. There's some diseases, things like pod and stem blight, top dieback is one of the diseases. And that happens, you will see that more and more as the season progresses. The beans may green up again, and then they'll yellow up again if we get a new flush of nematodes or new infections.
You know, when folks go out to the field, and you know, when it dries out enough, they can get back out in the field and walk around, what are some scouting techniques that you found to be successful? So if they're going to be looking for perhaps the presence of SCN, or maybe interested in samples for egg counts, how do they differentiate what they're looking at, so they're not just looking at soybean, you know, nodules, so to speak? Is there something there with the naked eye or a good hand lens? What's helpful?
Well, sure, hand lens always helps. And I think the the difference between SCN, female SCNs on the SCN on the outside of the roots and nodules is those the SCN are smooth, they're small, they're lemon shaped. The nodules are going to be larger, tend to be a lot larger and irregular shaped. So there's a shape difference. The SCN go through, there's more than one generation a year, and that's one of the things you have to be careful about. You could be out there, even though it's heavily infested, and at that the time you get out there, we don't have females on the outside of the roots. Their eggs or their larvae inside the roots yet, immatures inside the roots. I think the first thing to do is if you suspect SCN, you've got some plants that are stunted or yellow and stunted. They don't necessarily have to be yellow. Just dig or pull up some roots as long as you can get a good chunk of the root system and look at those roots for SCN. If you see them, you know, that's see females on those roots. That's an indication that there's reproduction going on. Particularly if you've got if you're worried about your SCN resistance in that variety not performing as well as it should. If you start seeing a lot of SCN on an 88788 variety, or it can even happen now on Peking varieties. That's a clue that something's got to change in your management. If you still suspect nematodes and you don't see any, you've got an option to just come back in a couple weeks, see if you see more nematodes on the outside then, or take a soil sample. And there's a lot of instructions on the U of M website and in the link there on how to take soil samples. But I think the big caution is if you've got a bunch of dead plants, don't take that sample just in that horrible area. Take it on a little bit to the edge and make sure you get some samples where there's enough root system left to support the SCN.
Well, we're here getting to the last week in July next week. Traditionally, has this been a good time to really start that, or would you go early August? And the other question is, all this wet weather that we've had, is that going to complicate some of this analysis or the survivability of the nematodes?
Well, they don't mind wet weather at all. In fact, that's how they get through the soil, is the larvae swim. So the wet weather isn't going to bother them. They're not going to drown. The thing that's complicating is that if you've got a lot of wet weather, that's an excellent question, Dave, because if you have good soil moisture, you're less likely to see dramatic symptoms. And the simple reason for that is those soybean plants don't need as good a root system to take up water, because, you know, it's easily available. If you've got drier conditions, you know, then the effect of that SCN injury on those roots is more pronounced.
Well, I know the nearby forecast indicates warmer than average temperatures than we have been having. It seems like it's going to be a little bit drier unless it really changes. So I would surmise that, you know, the first 2 weeks, like we normally get sometimes here, could be drier. And so what you're saying is, you know, that first, second week in August are still going to be prime times, correct?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I think that's going to be the case for not just SCN, but a lot of the root diseases, as those plants have a harder time getting to water, you're going to see the impaired root system show up more.
Any thoughts on any other diseases that might be appearing? I know we've been talking about Phytophthora on different segments and different things that we've done here in Extension and taking and looking out there. But I'm certainly Phytophthora is not just an early spring disease. It can show up later in the year here. We have a plant disease clinic on campus that can help with some of those situations. So that might be helpful. I don't know if you've had any other observations, or has it been more of a situation, would you say, just in terms of excess moisture for a lot of these soybeans at this point?
Well, there's definitely disease out there. I mean, it kind of, if you've got moisture, it kind of depends on what your temperature is as far as which diseases are going to take the most advantage of that environment. But we've got, even in spite of being wet and not that cool earlier, we saw quite a bit of rhizoctonia out there, Pythium early on, Phytophthora. I think what we're going to, you know, I don't know this, but I sure suspect the way the weather we've had earlier, the hot weather is going to slow it down a little bit, but I would be surprised if we didn't see quite a bit of white mold this year. And I'm reasonably certain that we had some pretty significant SDS infections early on, and those symptoms will show up more if it's hot and dry also.
Let's go back to SCN or soybean cyst nematode for a little bit. Let's say, for example, you have an opportunity to take a soil sample. And I don't know how often, you know, people are going to do that in a situation in a particular field. Sometimes, frequently, sometimes not, you know, many, many years will go by. But sometimes these numbers are fairly low. Sometimes these numbers are really high. Is there any thought that you might have one over the other? I don't know if necessarily if we pinned a number of a 1,500 or 2,000, depending upon, you know, cubic centimeter of soil, but or do you really look more about the presence of high numbers over time?
Well, I think the first thing is detecting an issue. And we, in southern Minnesota particularly, we could pretty much assume that there's SCN at some level in most, if not all, fields. What we're trying to avoid is these real high populations, and particularly where we're using resistant varieties. If we start picking up big numbers in a soil sample and you've planted the resistant variety, either that variety doesn't have good resistance, or the nematodes have in that field have evolved to be able to reproduce just fine on it. And both cases are true. We see a lot of both. So I think that's the big reason you're sampling, is to find out if your management is still working. Mm-hmm. And if you're starting to see a lot of SCN on a good resistant variety, you probably need to change sources of resistance. And, you know, maybe use Peking. You don't want to use that too often, but throw a Peking variety into that rotation to kind of help slow that resistance development down or combat it a little bit.
If you're, say, for example, staying with one particular supplier, one seed company, and maybe there isn't a limited amount of Peking, but, you know, it's some of the other 88, 788, and so forth, is it still good to rotate amongst that? Because not everything is identical, correct?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, and I think this is where a lot of guys get in trouble, is they'll plant an SCN variety and they'll buy it from three different companies. But say they're all a group 2-2, and their agronomics are similar, it's really possible you could have the same variety in different colored seed bags. So make sure you're actually rotating 8878 varieties, not just planting the same thing out of a different bag.
Yes. Or even if you're staying in the same company, rotate around a little bit as
well. Oh, yeah. Within a company.
In there. Any last thoughts here on soybeans? I don't know. We've got just a minute or two left here. We didn't really touch on it, but we'll be looking at, you know, corn whitworm and some other things, and we'll be talking about that later. But any last things that you wanted to cover?
Well, I mean, I'm tend to focus more on the insects, and I think right now in soybeans, it's important for people to make sure they're out there starting to evaluate soybean aphid populations. Those are going to ramp up as these soybeans go through the R3 and early R4 stages. Happens every year about this time, and we'll see some pretty rapid population increases. I'm kind of starting to see that in a few fields right now. I talked to a consultant over your part of the world that was evidently practiced spraying soybean aphids just so he knew how to make a recommendation. I don't know, but as you know, I definitely use the thresholds, because just because you see aphids out there, or just because you see these little isolated hotspots out there, it's no reason to treat a whole field.
Yeah, we're still at what, 250 per plant, 80% of the plants in the field.
Yeah.
Okay. Hasn't changed there. And if people have questions, we didn't cover it here. There's a number of articles, Minnesota Crop News.
Yep, and there's a link to a whole bunch of soybean aphid information on the web and also SCN information.
Okay, great. Well, thank you, Bruce. We're going to switch over here and bring in Melissa. Melissa is our assistant professor in the Department of Soil and Water Quality here at the University of Minnesota. Melissa, we've had kind of a tough year. I mean, given the fact of getting into the field, people got their nitrogen down perhaps last fall, this spring. Now, there are different sources, obviously, commercial fertilizer. But in the case of things that you're working with, and that is in terms of the proper management and timing of livestock manure with that, you know, and sometimes when we have wet weather, Melissa, we have wet weather all the way down. It doesn't make any difference. But if it's converted and if it's in the nitrate format, so forth, that could be there. But what's your observations and kinds of calls that you have been getting in here and in terms of that manure management timing, and also looking forward to what should we think about this fall? I mean, some of the small grains are going to come off. There's going to be an opportunity for applications here, but you know, the summer's not over. So the floor is yours.
Yeah, well, with the wet weather, we've been seeing a lot of variability across the fields, whether it's fertilizer or manure, especially in those low areas. The corn is looking fairly yellow. A lot of that is due to kind of what you talked about. Nitrate can change different forms in the soil, or nitrogen can change forms in the soil, nitrate being one of them. And nitrate's the one that we kind of don't necessarily want it to be in, mostly because it can move with rainwater, and it's been a very rainy year. So with warm conditions, the microbes in the soil are kind of kicked into overdrive that convert that nitrogen from organic forms if it's manure, ammonium forms if it's fertilizer or manure, and gets it into that nitrate form pretty rapidly within, you know, days to weeks. And then when you have all these rain conditions that are kind of driving water further and further down into the soil profile, that's when we're seeing our nitrogen losses. The other thing that we can see with nitrate is it can turn into a gas, and that's another microbial process. So when you get really saturated soils, like in the low spots of your field, unfortunately, the way that some of the microbes get oxygen is actually from nitrate, because it's not getting oxygen, you know, from the air mixing in anymore. So it pulls the oxygen from the nitrate, and the nitrogen part then turns back into a gas and can be lost. So there's kind of those two competing things going on with these wet conditions. And that's why we see a lot of these nitrogen losses and why we see variability across the field, because, you know, low spots are going to obviously have those saturated conditions, but you can even have, you know, in your heavy soils that might be in one spot of your field, but not another. We can see some of that happening too. The difference between manure and commercial fertilizer is that commercial fertilizer is usually in the ammonium form or the nitrate form already, or it's in urea, which changes very quickly to ammonium. So with manure, it's a little bit of a different story, and it depends on the manure that you're working with. Something like a finishing swine barn manure actually has a lot of the nitrogen already in the ammonium form. Some of our data from manure testing labs here in the state shows us that it can be anywhere from 70 to 80%. I've even seen some up in the 90 percentiles, where most of the nitrogen is in that ammonium form already. So it's already acting pretty much exactly like a commercial fertilizer would. But in other cases, like a dairy manure or a beef manure that might be stored as a liquid, it might be more like 50-50. So it does take longer to break down that nitrogen to get it into the nitrogen form. So in some years, that can be really beneficial, because that means it's kind of more of a slow release nitrogen. Unfortunately, this year we had a lot of manure go on in the fall, and then it was a really warm winter. So we're seeing a lot of variability in our manure fields, and I have some comparisons directly comparing fall manure applied to spring fertilizer this year down in Waseca. And for the first 2 years, manure outperformed fertilizer in both of those years that we did that. But the past 2 years, it's almost switched. Down in Waseca last year, they had that really wet spring. So the manure that had been applied in the fall, unfortunately, you know, some of that had converted to nitrate, and then we lost that nitrate in that wet spring. I think it was like May had an insane amount of water.
So you mentioned outperformed. Can you define when you say outperformed in terms of loss or yield, but what's your definition of performance here?
Great question. Yes. In that case, we had higher yields where we had manure in for the kind of first 2 years where we were doing some of these comparisons. But the last 2 years, because of the weather conditions, we're looking to have lower yields in our manured fields when we have fall applied the manure.
So the weather conditions that are when you're at a disadvantage are what, wetter than normal and in situations with that?
Situations where you can like where the fall applied nutrients can convert to nitrate. So warm winters, wet springs, those sorts of things.
Yeah. Well, we're warmer now. We didn't have really any much over 90 degrees this summer so far. We've touched it a little bit and here and there in places with that. Thinking ahead here to this late summer and fall, as we remove, you know, maybe a small grain crop or other types of things, it might be a canning crop in some places, but it opens up an opportunity for manure applications. Some of this could occur in the month of August, some in September. Any management considerations here for maybe not only, you know, swine manure, but I've seen, you know, everything from turkey litter to you name it piled up on the edge of the field. But what about that time of the year here when we're not really into what I call the true cold fall?
Yeah. So we always recommend putting on fall applying manure. If you're going to do it, get it on when the soil temperatures are cool, just because of everything I've just been talking about. You put it on in August when it's still warm, in September when it's still warm, you're risking conversion to nitrate and then you're risking loss. So if you are putting it on and you're growing something afterwards, like we've had pretty good success growing like hybrid rye, where we've put on manure pretty early in August or September and then applied or then planted hybrid rye. And that looked really good going into the fall. It looked better than where we didn't have any nutrients. Or we're going to spring apply the nutrients then. So getting roots in the ground, if you're going to put manure on that early, is going to be important just to make sure we're not losing the value of that nitrogen, particularly with fertilizer prices so high, right? Like if we're using manure, we want to get the best value we can out of it. So making sure that we're capturing those nutrients and keeping them up in the soil rather than in our groundwater is important.
You know, with swine manure, oftentimes you see in the fall or the late summer, the opportunity, you know, with large hoses and injection and so forth. Is that even in the month of August and September, you know, that injection still is, you know, a good alternative to at least consider here, isn't it? Versus just trying to leave a surface apply.
Yeah, and surface application, what happens there is the ammonium can actually turn into a gas. So that one usually sticks in the soil, but if it's on the surface, it can turn into a gas. So making sure it gets into the soil is important, especially with something like a swine manure, because it does have a lot of ammonium to begin with. And like, that's one of the reasons there's a bunch of things that actually cause odor in manure, but ammonium is one of them. So if you can smell it, that means you're losing nutrients.
You know, if you have an idea of what you normally do or need for from a fertility standpoint, and you might use our nitrogen calculator that's online, other sources, or have a soil test for P and K. But if you want to take a look at your analysis of what have you found over the years? I mean, we've had tables that are general in nature and talk about nutrient content of various manures and moisture levels. But is it still really good to, you know, take the opportunity to get an analysis on your own manure or your neighbors here?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that we've been finding, we've been working with a lot of the local labs, and I actually have a project where we're working with nationally a lot of different labs, and we're able to track these changes over time. And one of the big things we've learned is that there is so much variability, even within Minnesota. There's so much variability. A swine manure is not an average swine manure. Like it can be off by 20, 30 pounds of nitrogen per 1,000 gallons. And that's a big deal when we're considering, you know, a fertilizer bill, right? Like if you're applying 40 pounds per 1,000 gallons, but you're actually only applying 30, that's, you know, a pretty big deal when you're applying 4,000 or 5,000, 6,000 gallons. So getting it tested is critical. And the big things are, if you're like have a really consistent barn, you're not changing your feed, you might be able to get away with doing the first 3 years of an analysis in a new barn, and then you could do every couple of years after that, particularly if you're not changing anything. But if you're changing anything, you're adding different feed, you have different waterers, you notice you're using a lot more water because it's warm, you know, things can potentially change in that manure. So getting it tested fairly regularly, every couple of years, is definitely recommended. If you're changing things often, then maybe even annually.
So the same thing, if it isn't manure that you're producing, obviously on your own farmstead, but it's from a neighbor or a source, like I mentioned before about the, you know, the poultry, and used to be the turkey aspect and so forth, it's good to do your due diligence there as well, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things you'll definitely want to get from them is a manure nutrient analysis, so that you know what kind of nutrients they're applying. Make sure you're getting application records. So hopefully like how much they applied and where they applied it. So that way, if for some reason a corner was missed or something, you can go back in and make sure to hit that with commercial fertilizer. And kind of think about your fertility too. Do you want them to apply, like, you know, there's a lot of variability in the field. So do you want them to apply a lower rate and then come back in and side dress nitrogen? We've been recommending that because it takes off some of the variability that we see with manure from year to year. But you can consider applying like a base phosphorus rate, for instance, so that you're applying your phosphorus needs for the plant and then coming back and adding the rest of the nitrogen that you missed, for instance. But there's all kinds of things to do. Just make sure to consider what you want to do for your fertility plan and then kind of plan around that.
Well, I would imagine in some places, some folks might be taking a deep nitrate test or other pre-side dress and nitrate tests. I mean, you would still recommend that to help fine tune that, so to speak?
Yeah. So one of the things that's interesting about Minnesota is a lot of the work on the PSNT, pre-side dress nitrate test, has been done on non-manured fields.
Mm-hmm.
We're actually just started some research projects. I think we've just finished up a full year. We're halfway into the second year looking at doing pre-side dress nitrate test in a manured field from the previous fall. So there might be manured fields that have done it, but it's like, wasn't when manure was applied the previous year. It was like a couple years ago. So we're trying to see if that is useful, and then we can make recommendations based on it. A lot of the other states actually only use the pre-side dress nitrate test in manured fields, at least when I worked in Maryland on the East Coast, a lot of them were using that only in manured fields. So it theoretically should work pretty well, but we're trying to build some data on that to just make sure that it's making and matching up in our Midwestern soils.
Any, looking to this fall, okay, past August, any final words about application? I know you mentioned a little bit about soil temperature and so forth, and compaction. Anything else that you want to mention about good best management practices for what I would call a true fall application here?
Yeah, definitely. The later you can get it on or closer to the soil temperatures reaching that 50 degrees, the better. And that's not necessarily a hard line. Like getting it on at 60 degrees mm-hmm. is better than getting it on at 70 degrees, which is better than getting it on at 80 degrees, and so on and so forth. So trying to aim for that is always good. If you need to get it on a little bit early and it's something like a swine manure, which has high ammonium, and it's only a few weeks earlier, we have seen some success using a nitrification inhibitor in the manure, but those only last for a few weeks. So if you're talking about putting it on in August or early September, it's not going to make it the rest of the way into the fall, because it, like everything else, is subject to microbial action in the soil. And if it's warm and wet, it's going to break down faster.
Okay, great. Well, any other last comments here at this point in time? If people do have questions, perhaps where they want to learn a little bit more, you've had various publications through Crop News. If they have to look at some standard analysis, you know, what I call the old checkbook method of I've got this manure, this type of manure, nutrient, so forth. There are some different references for that. Again, not necessarily that accurate, but at least a guidepost.
Yeah, we have, our website is manure.umn.edu for general guidance. We also just started a project I was talking about working with national labs, And you can actually access all of that data. We call it MNOR DB, DB
Okay.
standing for database. So that's mnordb.umn.edu. And you can pick like Minnesota, what kind of species you want to look at, that sort of thing. And that'll show you some of the averages and medians and stuff like that.
Okay. Well, great. Well, thank you, Melissa. We appreciate that that information. We want to thank again our hosts, in terms of our guests today, Bruce Potter and from the Southwest Experiment Station and Research Outreach Center at Lamberton, and Melissa from the Department of Soil and Water and Climate, to be with us here today on this Field Notes program. Also, we want to thank our sponsors again, the Minnesota Soybean Research and Promotion Council, along with the Minnesota Corn Research and Promotion Council.